Everything you own in your home probably at some point was on a ship. Our interconnected world keeps functioning because of just a handful of trade routes and on the high seas and maritime choke points that keep our economy flowing. What happens when one of these points, or more than one of these points, is challenged? We explore all of this on a special interview on today's Trumpet World.
But China is literally just pushing the U.S. out of East Asia. Now, that is something that should concern all of us. For decades, seven decades, this Mr. Krauthammer says that America has protected those areas and really brought peace to that part of the world. But since there is this U.S. retreat, well, then somebody and these other great powers are coming in to fill the vacuum. And that's headed in a direction that ought to alarm every single one of us. The South China Sea is just a massive body of water where there's just all kinds of commerce that flows through there. And it's going to dramatically affect world trade. So Iran has today the control of the Red Sea, and they want very much to get control of the Mediterranean Sea, so they will also have full control of the Suez Canal, and they will have that when Egypt allies with them. But they want more than that. They want control of the Mediterranean Sea. This has always been something really important. If you look at your history, if you're in a war in that part of the world and you have control of the Mediterranean, well, you usually win. So right now, Iran is blocking the Red Sea, and that's causing just a devastating loss to Germany and Europe as they have to go all the way around South Africa to get their goods coming back to Germany and, of course, going there to the Middle East in the first place. This is certainly something that Germany is mourning over and getting very angry about doing something about it. So this could become the big push.
That was a selection of clips from our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerard Fleury, and his program, The Key of David, on the importance of maritime trade and how global powers are trying to challenge each other in this realm. Welcome back to Trumpet World. This is Mihailo Zekic, subbing in for your regular host, Richard Palmer. So much of the world's peace depends on these critical points, as Mr. Fleury was talking about, on the Bab el-Mandeb, on the South China Sea. We get the trumpet, sometimes call these points sea gates. Since February, we've all been feeling what happens when one of these sea gates is closed. I'm referring to the Strait of Hormuz and the inability of Persian Gulf oil to be exported. We've all been feeling that when we go to fill up our cars. But the Strait of Hormuz is not the only maritime choke point that world powers are interested in. On Monday, Yemen's Houthi terror group, a proxy of Iran, declared they were going to have an embargo against Saudi Arabia and stop ships from using those ports there in the Red Sea area. They haven't, as of the time of recording, done much to enforce their claim, but everybody remembers what happened when they launched a similar blockade against Israel years back. China, meanwhile, is becoming increasingly aggressive around the waters of Taiwan. Last month, their Coast Guard had a massive operation interrogating through radio calls ships going to Taiwan's eastern coast. That's the coast that faces away from China. Some analysts consider this a potential dry run for a blockade or perhaps even an invasion of Taiwan. The whole world is feeling the effects of what happens when just one of these sea gates, Hormuz, is closed. What happens if more start to follow? Well, we spoke to Arthi Krishnan, the founder and CEO of Raksha Intelligence Futures, a risk analyst firm that helps inform operations for organizations from insurance brokers all the way to the United Nations. We focus on these two flashpoints of Yemen and of Taiwan, but these principles can apply to anywhere where our world is dependent on international trade. Okay, to start, if you could explain a little bit of your background, how one gets involved in intelligence analysis in the first place, what makes Raksha's formula unique?
Yeah, great. Well, thanks for having me. So my background, I've spent about 20 years in the international system with the United Nations and the International Red Cross. Started off my career in more humanitarian response, crisis response work at field level, meaning doing country operations and all of that sort of thing. And in the last sort of 10 to 12 years, much more strategic at headquarters, looking, doing a lot of forward-looking analysis on emerging risks and emerging crises. My last role was with the UN, with UNDP here in New York. And then I left in 2023 after just under 20 years and I set up Raksha. So Raksha is an anticipatory intelligence company. And it was set up because to respond to the gap that exists in the market, which is that we are often told we are caught by surprise. And what exists at the moment are usually like geopolitical risk consultancies that explain what is going on, or early warning threat intelligence dashboards that might give you a couple of hours or a couple of days notice that something might happen. What doesn't exist is having data that looks at shifting conditions and how it may lead to a crisis. And that's what we do. So we, our sort of value is that we look, we give our clients 6 to 18 months of advance warning that something might be shifting. And we look at a wide range of indicators to be able to do that, where AI, human, intertwined in the way we do our analytics. And yeah, that's us.
Now, of course, a lot of events seem quite spontaneous to casual observers. 6 to 18 months is a long window. What's catching a lot of people's attention this week, on Monday, the Houthis declared a blockade against Saudi Arabia in retaliation for the Saudis bombing their capital last week. There, of course, is the Iran war itself. It's probably not strange that one of their proxies would gear up like this, but from a perspective of 6 to 18 months, with what's happening in the Red Sea now and all the reverberations, what could, from your vantage point, you have seen leading up to this?
So we started to look at this actually last year, where we were starting to see an increased trend or increased occurrences of what we were calling transactional diplomacy at the time. And that was this administration changing tariff policies overnight, essentially, is what it felt like. And states having to renegotiate that on a bilateral basis and often having to give up a lot more than what is naturally, what was historically part of a tariff or trade deal. And so we started to track that. We were calling it transactional sovereignty, essentially. And this was going beyond anything like Ukraine, Russia, or anything else like that. In early 2026, in January, we started to analyze the border peace coming together and what it means for the Middle East policy. And we were very interested in who were becoming members of the Board of Peace and why were they getting into this. And you start to see a pattern where it is a lot more driven by capital markets rather than diplomacy. And then in March, we published our Geopolitical Fractures Report, which is our flagship report that we publish every year. And in that, we mentioned that we'll see the increase of choke points. And we specifically talked about Hormuz is one example of that, where it would be used as leverage, and that it's a fault line that exists. And we were assessing that this is what future crises and future attacks might look like, where you're actually looking at these sorts of choke points versus attacks on the ground.
So, in other words, even with something seemingly as non-related as trade policy between America and Europe, that focus on trade, that focus on pushing at pressure points regarding trade, that can lead directly, in a sense, to what's happening in Hormuz right now.
Because what you start to see is the intent behind that. Why do we, because it's not just about tariff. There's a reason why that happens, right? And what is it that you're asking for to exchange in order to reduce your tariff? So if you go back, if you go beyond the headlines and you go backwards and you go, why is this happening? Why is this happening? Why is this happening? You start to see that there's a pattern of wanting to have leverage over issues like critical minerals, over land, over straits, over oil. This is a repeat pattern. So what you're look and so we can also see very similarly what happened in Venezuela, what's happening in Cuba. They're all part of the same story. And when you start to see that come together, you go, this isn't about removing a dictator or whatever else. It's about oil. It's about access. That's what it's about.
Now, the Houthis, of course, are still licking their wounds from Israel's bombing campaign and their last blockade. Many major shippers are still avoiding the Red Sea because of the inherent risk from last time. What effects could the Houthis potentially instigate, and do they have the power to enforce their objectives?
Good question. So the Houthis, look, that strait is too big for any non-state actor to physically shut down. So they're not going to be able to physically shut down. What they are able, they can certainly cause meaningful disruption and found and from a foundational impact perspective, they will have significant impact. What they can do and what they are doing, and I think I was doing a quick search this morning as to what's happened as of today. I think three ships have already turned around because they're not wanting to take the risk of being shot at, and that's what Houthis can do. The pressure that they're applying, and this is the same as what we're seeing happening in Hormuz, is making it not viable for ships to go through the straits, and that comes down to risk of attacks, of wartime insurance becoming prohibitively expensive for ships to take on. And we're already seeing those impacts. I think even Hormuz this morning is practically not functioning. So you don't actually have to physically control the strait. You just have to make it that it is not viable. The risk of going through the strait is too high so that ships will actually end up turning around. And that's what's happening.
Of course, and Iran's been very successful with Hormuz in that way. Geography obviously plays a part into this. Is this just Iran grasping at whatever straws it can use against the West? Or between all these different maritime choke points, is there a particular strategy that Iran appears to be applying?
My reading of it is that it is a very, very specific strategy. Iran knows that they cannot win a military fight against the US. That they are degraded. They are degraded. That is true. But they wouldn't be able to match it. But what they can do is hit the pain points that not just the US, but the world rely on. And it's genius, to be honest, if you look at it in that way. And what I find fascinating about this is the timing of it. They've not actually changed their strategy in any way, regardless of what headlines are in American newspapers. They've not changed their strategy. The ceasefire deal that was, what, a month ago was entirely in their favor. And this has been their strategy from day one.
Is there any chance Iran obviously has leverage in other places, like in Somalia with al-Shabaab, Sudan? Are there any other choke points that they could theoretically leverage in the same way?
So I think what's interesting here is we need to look at who Iran's allies are. And yes, we know it's Hezbollah, but Hezbollah hasn't actively come into the space yet, but they're also distracted. The Houthis are now in. What I would suggest that with Iran attacking US bases in the region, the risk it is playing is that it will reduce the amount of allies it has. So, but what I've learned from this process and what we're all learning from this journey is we've underestimated this country, and their ability to maintain this stranglehold is not something we should underestimate.
Shifting gears a little bit, another flashpoint that is related to what we're seeing right now is Taiwan. China has been much more vocally aggressive in enforcing its claim over Taiwan. Last month, they've had the what some people called a dry run of a potential blockade. Is there any relation between what we're seeing in Taiwan right now and Iran, considering China and Iran have so close relations?
Yeah, so what a lot of analysts, and I'm in this bucket too, what we're studying is how this is now being looked at like a playbook. The threat of a blockade, not necessarily an invasion, putting that lever of pressure on straits, which is what Iran has done, is very similar to what's happening in Taiwan. Now, we are very distracted with the Gulf, but this is still moving. I think yesterday afternoon, the Chinese Coast Guard entered restricted waters, and that was the third time this month. So what we're starting to see is that they are pushing to get closer and closer to Taiwan's shores. And we see that as some that that is a credible indicator that they are moving towards blockade.
Are there any other fractures, as you would term it, to keep an eye out for if something is imminent, like, say, even just spikes in insurance prices going around Taiwan, etc.?
Yeah, certainly I would be looking at wartime risk insurance and where that's being who is pricing and where are they pricing. I would be looking at how ships are rerouting and where they're going to, because that's going to certainly have an impact on prices that impact on us, on our pockets. I would be looking at whether the Lloyd's Register are declaring certain straits uninsurable, which they haven't yet, and they've actually been they've stopped from wanting to do that. But that's a big one to watch as well.
Now, Taiwan, of course, is an advanced global economy. It is single-handedly provides most of the West with their semiconductors. I would venture to argue Taiwanese or Chinese involvement in Taiwan could be a bigger rupture in the global system than most of the other crises that have hit. What kind of ripple effects could we see if China did try to actually try something?
It will be a big one because, as you've said, Taiwan exports out the majority of chips that the world uses. The US has a very specific interest in ensuring that that doesn't get disrupted. And any kind of blockade will also, ironically, have a massive impact on China's economy, which, whilst their external trade looks healthy, domestically it is not healthy. They're reaching high points of inflation, and domestic spending has decreased. So it would massively have an impact on supply chains, on the cost of chip production, on AI CapEx, and nobody wants that. Regionally, no country wants any of that escalation to happen. It is not in anybody's interest for this to happen. The closing off the strait would also mean that goods cannot get to countries like Cambodia, to India, to Philippines, to anywhere in the region, and that's again not something anybody wants. So it will be a ma between if that happens, and including Hormuz and the Red Sea, it would be a triple chokehold for all of us.
Now, these are two small choke points, relatively speaking, as far as the globe is concerned, yet, as you mentioned, it affects everybody everywhere. The fact that even without any of these erupting just yet, just Hormuz and just the risk of these other places, what does that say about the health of our global international economic system? Could it sustain many more shocks like this?
I don't think so. And this is what our premise has been at Raksha, that geopolitics now plays out at the systems level, not at the state-based level. We have Over, I guess, post World War II, we designed a globalized world based on the assumption that the systems that underpin all of that are resilient. And we assume that it can continue to function. And any sort of attacks or risks are more between state to state. But this has left, it's been a massive fault line for us globally. And we're starting to see the fractures of this emerge. Choke points, critical minerals, subsea cables that are increasingly being attacked. Areas of the world, we watch insurance a lot as a marker. And what we're also starting to see is how insurance companies are pulling out of areas, completely declaring them uninsurable, which then also leaves a huge exposure for the rest of us. So this, and then the other thing is around the financial system. So what was interesting in Hormuz, when they wanted to charge a toll for ships going through, if you remember that from a few months ago, that toll was to be paid in yuan, not US dollars. And so what it starts to show is the increase of alternative currencies becoming mainstream. It's that de-dollarization argument. So when you put all of this together, you start to see that the systems we rely on to make the world function are porous, and it leaves it vulnerable to these sorts of attacks. And not and we strongly believe that if we keep going the way we're going, if the world, if all of this keeps unfolding the way it's unfolding, then our ability to hold on to a resilient economic architecture is at threat.
Now, you mentioned earlier the transactional view of the current administration. This is probably not going to go away once Donald Trump leaves office. Trump responded to Iran with probably the minimal possible incursion it possibly could have done, and that was still too much for many of the US public. It doesn't look like the US, which has traditionally been the guarantor of this system, is going to be able to keep at it for much longer. What happens, when there's a power vacuum?
So I mean, we're already seeing it, right? So it is really, I mean, there's a bit of a grief with this process too. Because you're right, the US has always been seen as a major power protector to a certain extent. And the administration has lost a lot of allies. What was interesting a few months ago was that the UK convened a meeting between like-minded allies to discuss the Iran issue, but the US was not invited to that meeting. So there are multiple poles of coalitions coming together that exclude the US. And what I believe we will see is new forms of these coalitions coming. Lessening of the there's only one country that's going to protect everybody, that sort of white knight syndrome, but the realization that for the world to work well, we need different forms of coalitions, a multipolarity of coalitions, which is occurring. So we know that I think last year, or early this year, I'm getting my timing mixed up, but China hosted a massive summit, and the states that it invited to that summit were, included Malaysia, included Russia. It was the forming of a different type of coalition. And then in the EU and the UK, excluding the US. So we're starting to see this a lot more. And that's what we see will continue to form, not the one single power holding, being responsible for everything, but multiple poles of coalitions.
Okay, those are the two areas on my mind. Of course, Bab el-Mandeb and Taiwan. From your vantage point, there's obviously a lot going on in the world. What is one potential flashpoint that you guys are seeing that maybe is not on other people's radar like it should be?
Yeah, we're looking as well at Pakistan and Saudi Arabia. Pakistan warned that any Saudi attack equates an attack on Pakistan, and that is something that we should be watching for, because if Pakistan desired to get involved in this in a more in a military way, that's a big flashpoint. We're also looking at what Hezbollah is doing and their non-entry, and if they start to enter into this, this will be another flashpoint as well.
Arthi Krishnan, it was a pleasure to speak to you again. Thank you so much again for making the time available. I hope you have a wonderful rest of your day.
Thank you.
That was again Arthi Krishnan from Raksha Intelligence Futures. Special thanks to her for agreeing to appear on the program. I think that interview was a good example of just how the trends that we talk about on the trumpet, these geopolitical events that may seem very far away, that may seem very irrelevant to what's going on at home, are not actually irrelevant to what's going on at home. They are very relevant. An analogy I like to use in describing world events is the butterfly effect, where if a butterfly flaps his wings as China, you get a mid-Atlantic hurricane. A fanciful metaphor, but you are seeing these kinds of butterfly effects on things happening in the south of Yemen, in Taiwan, hitting not just your wallet, but even risking nuclear proliferation around the world. Now, these two areas, the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, the South China Sea, we've put special attention to these places before, perhaps more than other areas. There's a method to the madness. And if you'd like to learn more, we have two articles in the show notes. China is steering the world towards war, and Iran gets a stranglehold on the Middle East. These are from our Philadelphia Trumpet print edition magazines from years back, but they're still very relevant to today. That's about all the time we have for on today's program. I'd like to thank again Arthi Krishnan for agreeing to appear on the show. I'd like to thank Victor Granados for engineering and production, Mr. Richard Palmer for allowing me to sub for you, and of course, you as usual, the viewer. We'll be back later in the week with our regular Week in Review program on Friday, and until then, keep watching your world.